call our next case, United States of America versus Robert Brace, number 20-1892. Mr. Wolford.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Wolford. I represent Robert Brace and two affiliated companies. I refer to them in the briefs as the Brace defendants, so it's shorthand. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. I don't know where you want to start. There's two issues that we're dealing with on the appeal, one of which was raised by the court, and that is the scope of appellate jurisdiction. As I outlined in the brief, the government doesn't disagree with me that the summary judgment order itself falls within the court's pendant appellate jurisdiction. The way that I characterize it in the brief is that it meets both tests post-Swint, and it's necessary for meaningful review, and it's also inextricably intertwined. The question then gets into how many other orders. We've raised some additional orders that we believe are also subject to review at this time, and that's where the parties part ways.
On the Daubert order, even assuming that we had pendant jurisdiction over that, why would we exercise it when I don't perceive that you've made any argument as to why the district court erred on its Daubert order?
Yes, sir. Well, there were some space limitations that I ran into having to deal with an extra argument that I wasn't planning to argue. So I did not argue specifically why the sanctions order, for example, should be overturned, why or vacated, why the Daubert order should be vacated. One thing I would say about the Daubert order, Your Honor, is there's actually two motions that were stricken by that. I don't even know that they qualify as Daubert. I mean, they were stricken as being untimely Daubert motions because of the rule that the court had about Daubert motions. I looked at, they're basically motions in limine. One deals with an expert, so arguably that's a Daubert motion, but what was objected to was not something that falls in with one of the four or five factors that you ordinarily think of in a Daubert motion. What it deals with is whether or not this expert should rely on his non-expert opinion in interpreting aerial photographs.
Counsel, are you waiving both Daubert and sanctions, since obviously they weren't mentioned?
I don't understand that. What do you mean by they weren't mentioned, Your Honor?
Well, I'm so sorry. I thought that in response to Judge Hardiman's question about not pointing out what the error was, you said because of time constraints, you didn't mention error as it relates to Daubert in your brief, and you also said that as to sanctions. Did I not hear you correctly?
Well, I didn't expand upon it. I did mention in a footnote exactly what I'm saying now, Your Honor, and no, I'm not waiving.
But we do have precedent that says that just saying something in a footnote is not sufficient to preserve it.
But it's preserved, Your Honor. The issue is whether or not it is actually a Daubert motion. And all you have to do is look at it. The second order or second motion that was stricken by the district court was the exclusion of photographic evidence. That's not a Daubert motion. And so that was I'm not even sure that was the underlying same photographic evidence that was part of the first motion. So I think it's pretty self-evident when you actually look at the motions that were stricken that they weren't really Daubert motions.
Well, you still have to develop the argument. It's not enough to just mention it in passing. We've got a lot of case law that says that. But I appreciate that you had space constraints, and I don't want to suggest that, you know, you didn't put your best foot forward. I thought your brief was very well presented, but gee whiz, your predecessor counsel did not cover himself in glory, and we're really sort of stuck here with this, what appeared to me to be sort of an abomination in the district court. I mean, the district court judge gave your predecessor a lot of leeway, did she not?
Well, I reviewed the docket. I would say that Mr. Kogan was bumbling. I would say that he was incompetent. I would say that he didn't follow the rules, but this particular district court is very stringent about particularly following rules. And
there was extension after extension, there were admonitions to follow the rules, and then you get 9,000 pages, including several hundred pages that are just duplicated. I don't think it takes a stickler to object to a volume that's, you know, larger than War and Peace.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor. I looked at those documents, and this is why when it came to the history of the dilatoriness, I had no basis to challenge it. I mean, Mr. Kogan, I don't even understand why he's practicing law. He can't, it looks to me like he couldn't keep a logical thought together. He doesn't know how to present evidence.
All right. Your strategy in your brief has been to blame him, and there's plenty of blame there, but you have never disavowed your client's awareness of what was going on. And I don't know that you could you? I mean, your client maintained a website following all of this litigation. So you're not claiming your client was blissfully ignorant of all that was going on, that was protracting this and filing it all, are you? Do you have any basis in the record to make that assertion?
No, Your Honor, I don't have a basis in the record to make the assertion, nor does the district court have a basis in the record for making the assertion that Mr. Brace knew what was going on with regard to...
As an officer of the court,
yes, Your Honor.
Do you have any basis for representing to me that Mr. Brace did not know?
No, I have none. I also have no basis for offering to the court that he did know. I've never asked Mr. Brace what he knew or didn't know, because it was not relevant to what I was doing, which is to figure out whether or not the district court satisfied the first element or the first factor of Polis. The court didn't know either. And one of the problems that I found with this case is that the court would admonish in various contexts Mr. Kogan for trying to relate the two cases, the 1990 case and the 2017 case, together. And every time they would argue, for example, well, the government's not prejudiced because they've had this exhibit already in the other case. She would admonish Mr. Kogan for, well, you're not allowed to talk about the 1990 case. But then in other contexts, the court has no problem bringing up the 1990 case. And in fact, using the 1990 case is why Mr. Brace should know something about Mr. Kogan's misbehavior. Mr. Kogan wasn't hired until 2017. The lawyer that represented Brace in the 1990 action was a guy named Hank Ingram. I knew Hank. He died in 2003. So why a 30-year problem with the government should be used to say, well, you must know what your new lawyer is doing in terms of his incompetence. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Counsel, I'm sorry, Judge Greeney, please go ahead.
Yeah. Counsel, let's just focus on the Poulos factors for a moment.
Sure.
You'd agree with the proposition that let me ask you this. Is there any basis to disturb the orders entered absent a review of the Poulos determinations of the district court?
I'm not sure I understand the question. It's an abuse of discretion standard, that the abuse of discretion is guided by Poulos. So why would you not apply Poulos?
Very good. So then you've made a good argument on personal responsibility. Tell me about the other five factors, which seem to certainly work in the favor of the government on this.
Well, I would disagree with that characterization, Your Honor. There was some prejudice, but the nature of prejudice, if you look at the case law, talks about prejudice. It's more than just merely strategic, that it has to rise to the level of, like if you look at a lot of the cases where prejudice was relied on heavily, it's the eve of trial disclosures. You know, somebody files a pre-hearing memo, and for the first time, an expert report is thrown in there. And no one has an opportunity to respond to that. That's not what was going on here. What was going on?
Well, that's a persuasive way of saying in other cases there was more prejudice than there was here, but I'm not sure it's a persuasive way of saying there wasn't any prejudice to the government here. Why wasn't the government prejudiced by having to file motion after motion and deal with the obstreperous conduct of your predecessor?
Yeah, I didn't say there was no prejudice, Your Honor. I said it didn't rise to the level of the kinds of prejudice that you see in Scarborough, where they laid out five or six different elements.
Right. Well, that's true. But then are you saying that there was some prejudice to the government and that factor tilts in favor of the government, but only slightly?
I don't even know if it tilts in favor of them, only because what I noticed is the government had like five or six lawyers on this case. And every time Mr. Kogan made a misstep, like, you know, hours after he filed one of the briefs, literally hours after the deadline, and they responded with a motion to strike.
Just a way of saying that the government was forced to chase everything down to drag it out because of counsel's behavior.
You could characterize it as being forced, or you could characterize it as taking an opportunity.
All right, let's talk about...
Go ahead.
I would like to focus on something, and I don't know whether this might be an argument that Poulos doesn't apply at all or whether it goes to Poulos's fifth factor. But, you know, the fifth factor is about whether a sanction of less than, you know, entry of default judgment would suffice. And here, they didn't actually enter default judgment. This was striking a brief and then considering the summary judgment on the merits. So the government still had to satisfy its burden of proof. Isn't the holding of Anchorage Associates that an unopposed summary judgment motion is not tantamount to default judgment?
Well, you know, I found it interesting that the district court raised Anchorage and then immediately went to a Poulos analysis. And I think the reason is because the court recognized that Anchorage Associates doesn't really apply. The issue with Anchorage Associates is whether or not a local rule which provides for an automatic default can be used to...
So this case is kind of in between a classic Poulos case of flat-out entry default judgment and an Anchorage case. If we're thinking about whether we should extend Poulos modestly to apply to this situation, should we or shouldn't we? I mean, what would we do with factor five about lesser sanctions here? Because the district court did take a somewhat lesser sanction than just flat-out entering default judgment. It still held the government to its burden of proof.
I think we're mixing apples and oranges a little bit, Your Honor. What Anchorage Associates applies to is whether or not a party truly fails to respond. I mean, there were two things that it dealt with. Number one is, can a local rule be used to automatically enter judgment? And then number two is, what happens when a party totally fails to respond? And the reason that you can't apply Poulos in that context is that you have no basis to evaluate the factors. You don't know why, for example, the party didn't respond. And that was one of the things that the court talked about in Anchorage. And so here we know exactly why the summary judgment was entered. It followed everything being stricken, all defenses, any response. And so that's the sanction that triggers Poulos. When you're talking about the fifth Poulos factor, about which sanction to apply, I advocated hard, you know, very strenuously in the brief that I think this case was very well suited for financial sanctions early on. And I don't know why the district court didn't go in that direction, frankly. It almost looked like the court preferred to strike things instead of actually dealing with Mr. Kogan's misconduct head on. And I think had the court sort of straightened out Mr. Kogan early on, it may have had two effects. Number one, it may have had the effect of correcting his bad behavior. I'm not sure, because frankly, as I read all everything, I'm not sure Mr. Kogan's capable of representing someone adequately. But the other thing that it would have done is arguably put the Brace defendants on notice, which gets to Poulos factor one, is if now they have to pay a financial sanction, well, why would I have to pay this? Now we know that they are aware of Mr. Kogan's conduct. And so I think it would have had that effect as well. So.
Let's assume we agree with you. I think you made some good arguments there about how a monetary sanction on the lawyer might have gotten this case back on track. But if factor five and factor one go your way, aren't you still on the short end when we look at factors two, three, four, and six?
Well, as I said in the brief, I'm not going to argue the history of dilatoriness because, I mean, it was obvious. But I did, I think that this, I mean.
And on Wilf, maybe we should look at Wilf in this on factor four, because I think you've also made a good argument that the record is, that we should be somewhat agnostic about Mr. Brace's personal knowledge. It's, if I had to guess, I think he might have known, but the record doesn't really tell us that. So I think we ought to be cautious on that. But isn't it the case that factor four asks whether the conduct by the party or the party's attorney was willful or performed in bad faith? So even if Mr. Brace was completely unaware of the bad behavior, factor four still is sort of a slam dunk against him because of the fact that it could be the party's attorney.
Is it incompetence? Is it dereliction of duty, or is it bad faith? I mean, if you look at the case law, it requires something more like intentional self-serving conduct. And what the court did with this one is, in a footnote, assumed that the Brace defendants were directing Mr. Kogan because they wanted to continue farming the property, which is, I thought when I read that was frankly outrageous. So one of the things that I did in my brief and that the court did not do and that the government didn't really do is weigh all the factors. Actually, you know, once you have all the factors, you know, you look at each one in isolation, then you weigh them. And if you look at page 48 of the brief, I pointed out how similar this case is to the Hillebrand case. Number one, the court trivialized the first Polis factor in a footnote and had no evidence whatsoever to reach the conclusion. And as I just described, the court also then invoked the 30-year litigation, even though the court would admonish Mr. Kogan every time he did that. The second Polis factor, there were a lot of instances of frustration, but the kind of material prejudice that I think it could have been correctable. It wasn't incurable, and I know that that's not the...
But can we go back to the fact for a minute? Because I'm not sure what you're... rejoinder is on the fourth factor. Is not repeatedly disregarding district court orders the definition of bad faith?
Well, if it were, then we wouldn't have to figure out if there was bad faith. You just look at the record and be done with it. But I think there is.
No, I mean, we look in order to determine whether the lawyer was acting in bad faith, we look to the record, we look to the evidence. And what I'm suggesting here is the evidence in this case is that he repeatedly disregarded district court orders, repeatedly violated district court orders. And I'm asking, is that not bad faith?
I think it has to be willful. And I don't know that it was.
It was just inadvertent time and time again. I mean, that seems...
I wouldn't go that far either. I don't think it was inadvertent. I think he's totally incompetent. Frankly, I think he should be disbarred. But the question is whether or not his incompetence should be visited on the Brace defendants. He did provide it. He said, look, I'm a solo practitioner. I'm very busy. But, you know, those sorts of things, which have been relied upon in other courts as a lack of the level of intentional willfulness needed to demonstrate the fourth Polis factor.
But he was lying. He wasn't a solo practitioner. He'd had co-counsel coming in and signing pleadings, et cetera. He's just throwing up a cloud of excuses here.
He misrepresented
his own practice status to the court. That sounds like willful or bad faith to me.
But I find it interesting that, you know, we can point to those examples of where he's willing to deceive people, but we think at the same time that he's following the rules of professional conduct when it comes to informing Mr. Brace of his misdeeds. I mean, at the end of the day, we're punishing a party for something that Mr. Kogan did. I mean, really, that's the problem. And
I think there's some truth to that, but is that not inherent in the adversary system? Parties typically hire lawyers, they don't represent themselves, and sometimes lawyers let them down.
Well, And that is what the first Polis factor is about. I mean, that's why there's an inquiry. That's why it's the first factor, as I pointed out in the brief, because it's probably the most important.
Well, like I said, if you prevail on factor one and factor five, we still have the other factors to deal with. And we have to balance all six factors, right? We have to weigh and evaluate all six factors.
Yeah, and I did that in the brief. For the sixth one, for example, the court did not conduct a meritorious analysis. The court basically incorporated by reference the summary judgment analysis that was stripped of all defenses. The whole point of a meritorious analysis is if the sanction is not imposed, is there merit to the other side's case? Well, she didn't do that. What she did is she said, well, we're going to strip all of the defenses away and then see whether or not the government has a prima facie case. And then we're going to use that for the meritorious analysis, which, you know, so that one weighs again in favor of the Brace defendants. And I've seen some cases where, you know, if you have one or two factors that favor dismissal or reversal rather, that you should do that, because the one overriding theme is that the court has a strong preference to get to the merits. And that's another thing that the district court didn't do in the opinion, is she didn't discuss whether or not that was even considered. And I forget which case it was. That was the sole basis that the case was reversed, because the court failed to do that. And so, you know, these things, because they're very factual, obviously, we don't have good facts. We have a lousy record. We have a docket with the docket entries. We can see that. And we have characterizations of Mr. Kogan's misconduct. That's what we have. And in close cases, whether it's Hildebrand or Scarborough, those kinds of cases, typically the court reverses so that the case can be heard on the merits. I think this case is more like that than the outrageous conduct that you see in some of the pro se cases and that sort of thing, or, you know, there's a lot of non-pros cases, pro se cases. I mean, you can see that no matter what you do, the case is not going to get straightened out. On this one, it's, you know, Mr. Kogan, after the summary judgment motion was decided, was fired. So he's not around anymore. So now he has competent counsel. Whether competent counsel has anything to work with to defend him, you know, it depends on you folks. But one of the things that I think is a little bit different about this case too is it's an enforcement action against somebody. A lot of these cases deal with plaintiffs that bring cases and then don't do anything with it. And so it's, you know, pretty easy to understand. Well, look, if you don't care about your case, why should we? This is he's been enforced against by the government. And so if you're weighing, if we have some doubt about things, he ought to be given his due process. And he ought to have some defenses. If you look at the partial judgment order, and we haven't talked about that, I don't know if you folks want to talk about that. It was inexplicable why the judge struck all of the affirmative defenses the first time around, and then she did it a second time around. And so, you know, the whole case is about, we have this historic problem. Brace doesn't want to go down the same road. He calls the EPA, he calls the Corps of Engineers. They come to the site, they say, you can do this and this, but you can't do this and this. He follows what they say, and then they enforce against him. And then the first thing that the court does is say, well, we're not going to let you raise that as a defense. I mean, it's kind of outrageous when I look at it. And then when you compound that with Mr. Kogan, he's just ridiculous. It would be nice if the Brace defendants could actually defend themselves on the merits with competent counsel. I think that would happen if the court were willing to remand the matter.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wolford. We'll hear you on rebuttal. Let's hear from Ms. Durkee. You're on mute, Ms. Durkee.
Sorry about that. I'm Ellen Durkee for the United States. This court should affirm because the district court striking of defendants' second non-compliant opposition to summary judgment was not an abuse of discretion. An abuse of discretion is a deferential standard and occurs only where a district court's decision is arbitrary, fanciful, or clearly unreasonable. in short, where no reasonable judge would have stricken the defendant's submission under the circumstances of this case. I propose to start and focus on defendant's central argument that the district court's consideration and balancing of the Poulos factors was an abuse of discretion because the parties are not that far apart on the jurisdiction, although we do disagree.
You agree that Poulos has to apply here?
No, I mean, I think that our argument is that for this, the striking of the second summary judgment opposition, the teaching of Anchorage Associates is that if there is no response to a summary judgment motion that the district court can consider, then Poulos does not apply. And that's essentially the situation that we have here because they didn't file a compliant summary judgment opposition. The district court tried very hard and was very patient to get something viable she could consider. And they completely defied her instructions and order. And so I think that the logical outgrowth of Anchorage Associates is that Poulos does not apply in this case.
Ms. Durkee, I think this case is not exactly Anchorage, but it's not exactly a classic Poulos case either. Even if we don't have to apply Poulos, wouldn't it make sense to apply Poulos? We'd have to tweak factor five because this is a slightly lesser sanction. But wouldn't it help to structure district court consideration, help to structure our appellate review? Isn't it just better to make them walk through the steps? I think your friend's argument on the other side had some force, which is in a classic default judgment case, you just have nothing from the other side to review or to weigh why they didn't or what. And here we have a lengthy history, so we can apply the Poulos factors. Why not go that route even if it's not exactly a classic Poulos case?
Well, I think in this case, we're not faced with what the court was faced in Anchorage Associates, which is that the court didn't apply the Poulos factors at all. And therefore there had, that was a threshold question. I do think that in here, the district court said, you know, I'm not sure if it replies. There's reasons to think it might not, but I will apply them. And it did apply them. So I don't think,
You think she did it for bootstrapping reasons, not because she felt she had to apply Poulos?
No, I think she was very conscientious and said, all right, let's assume it applies. I don't think it was just bootstrapping. I think that she really wanted to address the Poulos factors, and she made a very compelling case as to why the Poulos factors, that it was appropriate to strike under, after consideration of the Poulos factors. And so, I have to, acknowledge that we're not aware of a case exactly in this situation where it was stricken and then it was uncontested. Anchorage Associates was no filing at all. And if that's the difference, that's fine. But here I think that there's no reason to remand or to be concerned necessarily about the application of Poulos because the court went through the full analysis.
But the court clearly made some errors under Poulos, correct? On factor one, the court erred because it did not really make a proper record finding about Brace's responsibility, did it?
I disagree that that's an error. What the court said was from the record, she could not, it was ambiguous. That means it was ambiguous to the extent that, for both parties,
But if it's ambiguous, then you can't really assume that Brace was responsible for the delay, right? Don't you have to have some proof or evidence that Brace was responsible for the delay? Is it enough to have a hunch or a suspicion that he was responsible for the delay?
Well, I think if you look at Poulos itself, and you look at the Ware case is another example, the court has upheld a sanction under Poulos under the assumption that there was no, party bore no responsibility for the misconduct, stating in Poulos, in fact, that you know, sometimes parties bear, you know, bear the consequences of their agents, their attorneys' behavior.
Sure. Sure. No, that all that means is that all that means is even if factor one goes the in favor of Brace, that doesn't mean the other factors don't outweigh that. But I'm trying to go through the factors now, and it looks to me like an error was made on factor one. Factor five, alternative sanctions, that wasn't done. There was no sort of progressive discipline here by the district court. And then factor six, you've conceded, you know, kudos for your candor. You've conceded that there was error on factor six. So it looks like we've got three factors going for Brace and three factors for the government. Obviously, dilatoriness, opposing counsel conceded and goes tremendously in favor of the government. I think factor four goes in favor of the government because of the attorney's bad faith and willfulness. So if we're sort of in equipoise here about the six factors, why is not there some merit to Mr. Wolford's point that here we don't have the typical Poulos case where we have an intransigent or incompetent plaintiff failing to prosecute the case? We've got someone in a defensive posture. And it really, I know this isn't a criminal case, but it sort of has the feel of a criminal case where defense counsel is engaging in ineffective assistance of counsel. Not only was there a bad defense here, there was no defense. And the absence of defense, the willfulness, the dilatoriness, the obstreperousness of defense counsel went a long way toward turning the court against the defendant. Is there any good answer to that other than, well, you know, that happens if you hire a bad lawyer, and that's the nature of our adversary system?
Well, I think there were several questions in that. And so I'd like to again talk about the extent of personal responsibility factor. The district court, you know, considered this, and in cases, for example, like where the courts found there was no, you know, in Poulos, in some of the cases it was assumed, they didn't know, but it was assumed, this court assumed that the client was not aware of the misconduct, and yet upheld the district court's sanction. And in this case, the district court specifically said that the ambiguity did not have to be resolved because even if the client was not aware, the other factors outweighed that. And, you know, and I do think that the court can also take into account two other things, which is, you know, there's an inference from, as we pointed out in our brief, from some of the various involvements of the Braces, you know, with the case, very active litigants, they have a website, you know, the dockets, you know, when I look at the website, the docket sheets up there. The other factor that's sort of being lost in this discussion is that by trying to blame Mr. Kogan and saying he was a solo practitioner, this ignores something that's in this case, which is that the Brace of Defendants had two other counsel who filed some of these stricken documents themselves, who were present at the hearings, who participated in discovery depositions, and they had a long, you know, term relationship with the Braces, had been attorneys since 2007, and they remain his counsel in district court here. So to say that, you know, it's only Mr. Kogan and he was, you know, a bad apple and so on, those attorneys also had a responsibility to keep them informed, and they were also involved. And no one's said that they, is trying to pin the blame on them. They're only trying to pin the blame on the person that's no longer involved.
All right, but did the district court make a finding on that? I don't remember it did.
well, she certainly pointed out that in the, you know, in the August 2019 order that he had two other attorneys, and she pointed out in numerous other orders along the way. I don't have the page numbers, you know, at the tip of my fingers here, but yes, she did.
No, I mean, you're clearly correct about the other lawyers. I remember reading that, but I'm asking whether the district court tied that up with an evaluation of factor one and made a fine. It would have been feasible for the district court to say, look, factor one works against Mr. Brace because not only does he have this incompetent lawyer, but he has these other lawyers, and I'm going to find, as a matter of fact, that the other lawyers discharge their professional responsibility to keep him informed of the status of the case. She didn't do any of that, did she?
Not in those exact words, no. But I guess the second point I'd like to make about this argument about the court's, you know, inability to make a finding given, you know, inferences in the record, but without, you know, total unambiguous, that it was still ambiguous. The argument the defendants make in their brief is that the court had a responsibility to initiate and conduct an evidentiary investigation. And I am not aware of any Poulos case that has required that of a district court. And I think that, you know, it seems like that would open up a lot of rabbit holes and objections to a district court calling in, you know, maybe even warring, you know, attorneys and their clients, and, you know, just probing into the attorney-client communications. I mean, the United States is not in a position to know what those communications were, but even saying that the district court has a responsibility to have this sort of sidebar mini trial is not something that I've seen this court require. Instead, what I've seen in Poulos cases is that where it's ambiguous, the assumption is that is either from the inferences, or, you know, the court is upheld when the district court has said other factors would outweigh that anyway. And that's what happened here. In terms of the alternative, the bad faith, I just want to like underscore one thing about, you know, the defendants keep talking about, well, there was a lot of dilatory conduct, a lot of late missed deadlines and so on and so forth. Not only were those not isolated incidents, that's not really the core of the problem. This, well, the core of the problem, you know, or at least the bigger, you know, prejudice and bad faith conduct is that the court gave very explicit instructions about how to file that second opposition to summary judgment. There could be no misunderstanding what the court said. The first opposition relied on over 30 exhibits and expert opinion that were not disclosed during discovery in this case. The court quite properly said, you can't do that. That's not, you know, that's violates all sorts of rules and, you know, 37. You have to disclose. They made no attempt to show why there was, you know, an exception here. So the court said, all right, I'll give you a second chance. You're going to refile your brief. You're going to, you know, excise any reference or reliance on these, you know, documents that are not properly relied on. And if you rely on any new materials or stricken materials, I will strike it. So what did they do? As the court details, you know, in multiple ways, they filed a very non-compliant second opposition, and it completely defied the order, because what they did was they resubmitted expert reports that had been expressly stricken. They added new opinions that had never been disclosed. They rewrote affidavits and put in exactly the same non-disclosed opinions of different paragraphs. And so this is not sort of, you know, these little inadvertent, I missed a deadline or, you know, this, that kind of, no, this was blatant this regard. And the court then allowed them to explain themselves. And among the explanation was, counsel said, I refiled things you struck in prior orders because I think your prior orders were erroneous. And we know that's not how courts work. And we know that's, you know, bad faith. That's not incompetence, that's bad faith. And the final thing I'd like to say about bad faith is the district court made a finding of fact of bad faith, and it is a finding of fact. And this court has said those kind of findings cannot be, those are reviewed under clearly erroneous standard, and there's no basis for saying it was clearly erroneous. Finally, on the alternative sanctions, the sanction of striking the second summary judgment submission did not come out of nowhere. It was after months of defiance of court orders, despite the court having given clear instructions, orders of clarification, second chances with increasingly stronger admonitions, then warnings of strikings, then the court struck. They struck the Daubert, the 2 month late Daubert submission. The court issued a show cause order for financial sanctions and asked for responses. And within 2 days after that final response, and therefore before the court could, you know, even turn to those, they filed two more. The Daubert motions at issue, which were 2 months late, and also while there was a show cause order pending for filing the exact kind of motions late in the first place. Given what we know about the abuse of discretion standard, what this court has said that you have to defer to the trial court's, you know, substantial authority and discretion to manage its courtroom, and what the court had seen in this case, the idea that financial sanctions here against the, you know, Mr. Hogan would have, you know, made a difference, you know, is not something that is unreasonable. You know, the court said that, you know, I'm not doing that because then that's not unreasonable. And this very experienced district court judge went to great lengths to try to get a viable response to the summary judgment motion. So, and gave a clear statement of what would happen if it didn't. But, you know, there's no reason to expect that financial sanctions would have gotten a compliant summary judgment opposition. In fact, you know, as I understood Mr. Walther to say, you know, he doesn't think that it would have done it, made a difference either with Mr. Hogan to give financial sanctions. So, you know, I don't think that the court can be faulted. And I don't think, and I guess the other, you know, the final question is, what can we do now? I mean, with financial sanctions, it still doesn't get a compliant summary judgment or opposition. So the court had to deal with the situation it had in front of it. And it made a reasonable determination, having, you know, told them exactly what they needed to do, having them basically say, we don't have to follow your orders. And then, it, you know, it dealt with it in the way that's quite appropriate, which is to strike things in the face of that kind of noncompliance. As far as the merits.
Ms. Durkee, you're way over time. Judge Greenaway, do you have any questions for Ms. Durkee?
No, sir.
No.
All right. Do you want to wrap up? Can you sum up?
I just would again urge the court to, you know, stay true to the abuse of discretion standard and look at and defer and know that the district court had the benefit of a ringside seat to 30 months of this kind of noncompliant behavior and bad faith behavior.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll hear Mr. Wolford's rebuttal. You're on mute, Mr. Wolford.
Thank you very much. I beg your pardon. And sorry about that. I want to start by taking exception to facts being discussed here that are not of record, and frankly, they're not in the briefs. You know, one of the things we just heard was that there's a docket sheet posted on the website. I have no idea if that's true. My guess is that whatever docket sheet may have been posted on there is probably from the 1990 case, but I don't know. And to suggest now that, you know, we had real-time docket entries on the website, I think is troubling, because there's no evidence of that in the record. Also, I'm unaware of Mr. Kogan ever saying to the court or representing to the court that, yeah, we know that your prior orders are, that we're about to violate them, but we disagree with them. I don't recall seeing anything like that. And so, you know, these kinds of factual assertions that aren't really part of the record, I think should be disregarded. With respect to the issue that keeps coming up about Anchorage, the summary judgment order in this case is a little different from a standard summary judgment order. You know, summary judgment order, ordinarily, you move for summary judgment and then the court rules on it. That's not what happened in this summary judgment order. There's actually two parts of the order. The first part is the sanction and the second part is the summary judgment. Polis applies here because of the first part. It was a sanction. I mean, it basically struck everything. And if you read Anchorage, as I said earlier, what the court looked at is the reason why Polis did not apply is because the court had no basis to figure out, the district court had no basis to figure out, well, why didn't they reply? Why didn't they file something? So you can't really evaluate the Polis factors. Here we know why the Brace defendants didn't reply, because it was stricken. And the court was, you know, figured this out, which is why the court did a Polis analysis, because it was a sanction. During the discussion that just occurred, the court pointed out that, well, we kind of have three factors against three factors. And so this is a close call and that sort of thing. I would remind the court that one of the central precepts is that when in doubt, this court prefers to hear cases on the merits. So if it's a close call, I think it should be remanded for a decision on the merits, particularly when you've got a government enforcement action. And I think the court's correct that this looks a lot like ineffective assistance of counsel, and it is an enforcement action. I mean, it's you're looking at a $400,000 penalty as an example of, you know, we're not done here, and there's probably going to be a lot more money involved in complying with the order on remedy. So I would make that point. Not surprisingly, the government relies very, very heavily on the dilatoriness factor and wants to rely on circumstantial evidence that, well, somebody must have said something to the Brace defendants just because there's other lawyers and, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, Ms. Durkee was correct. There were a couple of other lawyers, right? It wasn't all about Mr. Kogan.
That's correct. But once again, we don't have any record that they were, you know, following the case. And, you know, other than there's local counsel. And I've been involved with local counsel matters before where, you know, I get hired because there's a matter that arises in Erie, you know, Western District of Pennsylvania, and the lawyers that are doing the work are out of Texas or out of, you know, Massachusetts.
Why would we assume that local counsel would be so remarkably unhelpful as to not tell the client what was happening with all the missed deadlines with Mr. Kogan? That seems very counterintuitive, doesn't it?
It does, but I would respond to that. You shouldn't assume that, nor should you assume that they behave the other way. You shouldn't make any assumptions. It really comes down to what the record reflects. And so, you know, let's say, for example, that—
All right, but if we don't make any assumptions, then factor one is a wash. It doesn't help either side.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think it's the court's obligation, the district court's obligation to evaluate it. And as I said in my report—
She did evaluate it, and she came to the conclusion it was ambiguous.
Well, she
did. In other words, there's an aspect of equipoise on the first factor that she didn't find it probative in her balancing and weighing of the factors, right?
No, I disagree with that. She didn't actually evaluate it. What she did is she relegated it to a footnote, and then she applied a stretches credulity presumption that the court derived based on, well, they've been litigating for 30 years, so they must have known. I mean, the whole thing doesn't make any sense. And it violates the one rule that she had, don't you talk about that other case. And so she basically just decided that this one isn't important because I don't know the answer. So I'm going to assume things. And she did the same thing in footnote 10 on one of the other factors, which I think is totally improper. The other thing the government said is that there's no case law that requires an evidentiary investigation. We're not suggesting that the court needed to do an evidentiary investigation. However, in most of these cases, there's usually some sort of conference that occurs where the parties present, like Ware, for example, Ware was the party that he decided he wasn't going to show up for depositions. Well, okay, so if you're not showing up for depositions, then you're aware of the dilatory conduct because you're participating in it. We have nothing like that here. And rather than apply a presumption like the district court did, if you're really that in the dark about what they knew and when they knew it, then have that, you know, call everybody in for a settlement conference and say, you know, look across the table and say, are you aware that your lawyers are really screwing this up? There was nothing like that, and that really gets to the financial sanctions. You know, Poulos itself says we prefer financial sanctions, and there are other cases that say that because it does two things. Number one, it punishes the offending party, and it also gets to this knowledge of the party thing, because in that context, when financial sanctions start to be imposed, then people have to start telling people things, and so it forces the issue.
Are you suggesting that district court should be financially sanctioning innocent parties who are let down by their counsel?
I think that would be preferred to the ultimate sanction, yes. Before you impose the ultimate sanction, first I would start with the lawyer. If that doesn't work, then I would go to the party. And if that doesn't work, then the ultimate sanction. But I wouldn't just jump from, you know, A to Z without applying that first. And that the court has stated this in multiple cases, that that's the preferred approach.
All right. Mr. Wolford. You want to wrap up? Time has expired.
Yeah, the last thing I'll mention is the Dilbert motions are only Dilbert motions if they're Dilbert motions. I mean, I looked at them and they look like motions in limine to me. So on that issue, I think the record itself is self-evident. But in conclusion, I'll just finish up by saying, you know, it's a close case. There are factors on both sides, I think. Most of the cases like Scarborough, Hillebrand, and others where you have a close call, the court defaults to go to doing a remand so that the case can be heard on the merits. And on this one in particular, it is a government enforcement action, and you know you have no ability to defend yourself right now because of misconduct of a lawyer. If it gets sent back, it's not going to be Mr. Kogan, I can assure you, he's been fired. And then you know the Knox firm, who's representing him in the district court proceeding, will take over, and I'm sure that they would do a much better job. And I totally agree with the government that what was filed by Mr. Kogan is unacceptable. And I share the court's frustration, unacceptable. That won't happen again. But to have judgment entered against the Brace defendants on an enforcement action like this, because of the clear misconduct of their then lead counsel, I think is a little unfair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both, counsel. We appreciate the helpful argument, and we'll take the matter under advisement.